The year is 768, and a new round of Frankish conflicts have begun. Unlike previous divisions, this time the realm is supposedly ruled jointly by the two brothers who have succeeded Pippin the Short, the first Carolingian king of the Franks. Still, old habits of civil war seemed bound to take over, with the eldest brother Charles taking Austrasia, and the youngest taking Burgundy, splitting Neustria between them. Their first task as co-rulers would be to put down a rebellion in Aquitaine, which had been part of ongoing unrest over the last decade. Charles, known to us by his later great epithet as Charlemagne, would enthusiastically pursue this mission, executing an efficient campaign to put down the rebels. The older brother, though first agreeing to join Charlemagne, would mysteriously back out, seemingly to begin preparing for civil war. Charlemagne would finish his campaigning in Aquitaine, and, in a move that will characterize his long-coming reign, immediately prepare to turn his armies around and campaign again, this time against his brother and equal co-ruler. However, fate would seemingly intervene only a brief time later, with Charlemagne's younger brother dying in 771. Charlemagne would waste no time sending his armies to seize control over the vast lands left behind. With this, the vigorous young warrior now held the entirety of the Frankish kingdoms, and would soon begin drawing up plans for the next year's campaigns, and campaigns for the year after that, and for the year after that. Welcome back to Between the Seas. Today, we'll be transforming the Franks we've been talking about under the divided realms of the Merovingian kings and Carolingian mares into the Franks of Charlemagne. To understand Charlemagne, I think it's best to look at him as a mixture of the three main legacies behind him. First, you have the legacy of the Merovingians, with their traveling court and unmatched offensive ferocity. Second, you have the legacy of the Carolingians, the protectors of Christianity, anointed by the popes themselves, uniting their people through merit and practicality. Third, you have the legacy of the Romans, a society driven by institutions, where the written word holds sway, and all Europe rushes to identify as its subject. Thus, he can be seen as simultaneously being motivated by the Germanic nature of glorious conquest, the Christian nature of stewardship, and the Roman nature of uniformity and assimilation through institutions. Obviously, combining these three legacies of different times and worldviews is a difficult task, and an extremely ambitious one. Under Charlemagne, though, it would be made to work. Charlemagne, you see, was quite uniquely able to pursue these lofty goals. He was known for his characteristically regal presence, towering over his vassals and most of his population at 6'3", with a dark, bushy beard and a warrior's build. Personally, he was known to be charismatic and even jolly with those close to him, despite having the ability to be ruthlessly cold if needed. His education would be well-rounded, though lacking depth in certain fields, such as writing. It is perhaps this lack of depth which would lead him to constantly pursue learning throughout his life. Though he may not have been able to read or write, he would have texts read aloud to him wherever he went. In this way, he would continuously absorb knowledge from early Christian texts, military histories, Roman field manuals, and burgeoning books of poetry. He was known to be a faithfully committed Christian, taking the faith very seriously as a twin part of his reign. Despite this, Charlemagne was also known to take personal actions antithetical to this, with numerous mistresses from all walks and regular acts of brutality. Finally, he would hold a philosophy of seeing his realm as cornered, yet significantly stronger than the heathen groups around him, and this would yield a vision of continuous conquest. In almost every year of his staggering 41-year reign, he would organize and lead a full-scale military campaign. These campaigns would take place in all corners of his realm, and even beyond, pushing into all three regions of the Riverlands, as well as Spain, Italy, and the Low Countries. Before we list out his conquests, something we will do later, don't worry, let's take a look under the hood of Charlemagne's state. His core lands were in Austrasia, the lands surrounding the Rhine and Main rivers and the West Central Plateau. Like his predecessors, Charlemagne would engage in a continuous process of attempted centralization through solidifying his political formula. During Charlemagne's time, centralization would take the form of an attempted return to the institutions of the Roman Empire. He hoped to modify his formula so as to organize the state with an imperial bureaucracy from the top down, and get people to buy into his rule through posing as an Old Testament king, leading his people to victory while also protecting their morality. To see this idea of statehood in action, he only had to look at his neighbors, the Byzantines. To the Byzantines, the emperor was the vice-regent of God, acting in the manner of the Old Testament kings by leading the one universal realm of Christians against all who might wish to tear down their faith. Through this lens, much of Charlemagne's actions politically and in Italy began to make more sense. He would continually position himself as the protector of the Pope in Rome, protecting him when the Byzantines could not. While the Byzantine Church had been tearing itself apart over iconoclasm, or the attempt to remove depictions of Jesus and the saints in church art, the Carolingians had supported the Pope in Rome, who was firmly against the Byzantine actions. Although iconoclasm would eventually be ended by Irene, the rift between East and West would not be fully healed. Eventually, as we talked about in the series introduction, Charlemagne would receive his goal, being crowned Emperor of the Romans by the Pope himself. This would be a mutually beneficial agreement, and though Charlemagne would later act as though the Pope surprised him with the offer, it is clear that this action was a deliberate move on the part of both individuals. For Charlemagne, this positioned him as the most powerful and legitimate figure imaginable, a perfect prerequisite to his remodeling of the political formula. For the Pope, the motivations are more complex. As mentioned before, the Franks offered a chance for the Pope to be protected from the constant local threats of the Italian peninsula, and even within Rome itself. It also allowed the Pope to distance himself from the Byzantines, who, in addition to going through those years of iconoclasm, had consistently denied the Pope the honors and influence he felt were justified, being the prime patriarch of the one universal church. For the sake of the church, the Pope needed to prop up a figure who was able to protect the institution within Europe itself. Charlemagne also aligned strongly with the Latins when it came to church standardization and expansion, as we will find out shortly. And so, Pope Leo III and Charlemagne would pursue a concept known as Translatio Imperii, or the idea that the empire would always persist in one form or another. There is always a single empire that proceeded from one age to the next, and there too would be a single emperor. This emperorship had passed along from the original Romans and been lost in the year 797 by the Byzantines. Within Byzantium, the regent Irene had usurped the throne for herself after brutally ordering the blinding of her own son. Following this action, Irene's son, Emperor Constantine VI, would die presumably from his injuries. Irene would position herself as the sole ruler following this incident, providing a window to claim the title. Thus, the Pope would claim that the title had passed from Constantine VI to Charlemagne, confirming this at the coronation ceremony in Rome on Christmas Day 800. Getting back to the topic of Charlemagne's political formula, the ongoing process of strengthening church ties would allow the legitimacy he needed to push for his bureaucratic standardization. In composition, he was indeed able to create an imperial bureaucracy, though in practice, this would not be the one fully governed by formal state institutions like the Romans had done. The Frankish political formula had developed in such a way that administration was very localized and dependent upon regional individuals who were high in status, whether they be part of the church administration, the military, or large landholders. Their boundaries of administration relied more on historical development, which had been building for centuries due to the constant Frankish divides and self-sufficient village formations which had been taking place across Europe during the First Dark Age. These regional interests would not integrate well with a top-down, centralized, and standardized bureaucracy. Instead, Charlemagne's bureaucracy was much more comparable to the Merovingian system of old. While the Carolingians had changed the political formula to have legitimacy granted from their role as protectors of Christendom and the Church, it still relied very much on personal prestige and gravitas to verify how much this role was actually fulfilled by the leader. However, while the Merovingians would essentially have to start from scratch after each new round of dynastic conflict, building up an ad hoc band of followers based on the strength of their social status, the formula of the later Franks would rely on the localized administration as its solid base. There was far less ad hoc formation, as these local institutions were now essentially fixed and tied to their locality. The personal prestige and gravitas, therefore, only determined how liable these fixed interests were willing to follow the will of the king versus their own will. When there was a strong king with a resounding legitimacy, these local forces would form an extremely effective bureaucracy, able to mobilize all who rely on that organization. Charlemagne would supplement this with several tools, all of which were inspired by the church. First would be the imperial representatives, sent to these localities to make the king's will known. These would essentially act as political commissars, though their loyalty too was almost entirely dependent on the gravitas of Charlemagne himself, rather than being tied to some government department. Second would be an encouragement of list-making. Writing is something that Charlemagne would heavily encourage the expansion of during his reign, both within the church as well as in secular administration and culture. Local authorities would be tasked with using this ability to create lists of those people in their domains and how much land they are responsible for. From these lists, tax collection and mobilization for the army was executed. Executing these actions was normally the responsibility of the local count and bishop, who would often work in tandem for the purposes of administration. Mobilization of men for a campaign was also tied to these written resources. Men with a certain, quite large amount of land were required to join the warband if summoned. Men with lower amounts of land would be grouped together, and from them, one would be chosen to fight. The others would be responsible for providing his equipment and tending to his lands while he was gone. Which areas were mobilized was also governed by list, and was normally tied to a specific local administration, rather than generally across the realm, and only to deal with specific crises. Overall, the church would be the best example for a bureaucracy, and they, as before, would be intimately tied to administration of Charlemagne's state. Like the Carolingians prior to Charlemagne, he would engage actively in reforming the Catholic Church, so as to better support his own legitimacy and the administration of his constantly expanding empire. The main problem with the church by the time of the mid-700s was in its lack of organization. As explained in previous episodes, monasteries had taken the prime role of all church duties within inner Europe, including among the main Frankish power bases of the plateau. These monasteries were often founded almost independently on requests from traveling monks from neighboring realms. They would then create self-sufficient communities and gradually evangelize their chosen localities. The monasteries over time would even fortify themselves against attack and come to be responsible for their own local levies and taxes. Within them, doctrine had started to drift a long time prior, and teaching within many ranged from borderline to outright heretical to the church in Rome. Saint Bonifaci, an Anglo-Saxon cleric with direct pushing from Rome, would embark onto the plateau in 747 to attempt to reform this situation. He would, along with Frankish leadership, begin the arduous process of an integration of these scattered monasteries into a more common church structure. In addition to this organization, Saint Bonifaci would also revive organized conversion attempts to neighboring pagan Germanic provinces, most famously converting a large amount of Hessians after miraculously felling their sacred oak tree with only a few swings and help from the wind. He would eventually be martyred in his efforts, being executed by the Frisians after converting a number of their tribesmen. Under Charlemagne, this reform movement would continue and reach its greatest heights. Charlemagne would place himself as the symbolic head of the church, establishing the image of being charged by God with the protection of the universal church, and leading the effort of its expansion. The Pope, naturally, would claim a similar role, leading to an uneasy balance. This balance would manifest as the idea of two swords, one being wielded by the temporal emperor to protect and expand the church, and one being wielded by the Pope, possessing the throne of St. Peter, to ensure soundness and uniformity of doctrine within the church. During Charlemagne's time, however, it was clear which sword was dominant, something even the popes would be forced to accept as reality. The primary reform of the Catholic Church in the late 700s would be the revocation of the monastery as the prime religious administrative unit within inner Europe. In their place would be a more formal hierarchy, leading up to the Pope himself. Archbishoprics were created and expanded to inner Europe, with the Bishopric of Mainz being raised to the position of archbishop and granted responsibility over the entirety of the plateau. Several bishoprics were created under this role, usurping the power and influence of the monasteries within the administration. Several monastics would resent this change, leading to significant unrest, but, divided as they were, they would not be able to resist the change. Those who did would be removed from their position in the harshest cases, with one example of the lead monastic of St. Gallen being sent into exile on an island in Lake Constance. Though monasteries had been demoted, they would continue to hold a high place within inner European society, remaining linchpins of the local communities and economies, as well as places of learning and prayer. They would contribute to the explosion of writing taking place across Europe, as they meticulously copied texts ranging from classics of antiquity to church liturgies and poems. The most influential would become abbeys, and exemplify the rising medieval Christian culture of the age. Below the bishoprics who now held power would be individual parishes, now formalized within the hierarchy. To back up this administrative expansion would be a massive construction effort, undertaken both with resources of Charlemagne's empire as well as those of the new Catholic system. Hundreds of new churches would be constructed across the plateau and the wider empire, greatly helping to Christianize the remaining pagans. From these churches would be a great expansion of local elites and economic integration, He would also begin the construction of several cathedrals, giant churches designed with extreme care and artistic vision, made to be the centerpieces of larger towns. The most lavish cathedral would be the one built at Aachen, the town which could be considered closest to Charlemagne's capital. All of these churches would greatly enhance the reputation of this new church hierarchical system and cement their influence regionally. Within the church, Charlemagne would also seek reform. He would gather several of the most learned men of Christendom, ranging from Spain to the British Isles to Italy, to standardize and enliven the religion. New liturgies, or organized prayers, would be written in Latin and distributed to the newly established churches. Doctrinal issues arising from the independence of the monasteries would be settled and institutionalized. Education processes for clergy of all ranks would be overhauled and upgraded, aligning both with these new reforms and the essential doctrinal beliefs of the church. Processes for the appointments of bishops, priests, and clergy would be made to align with this training. Church hymns would also attempt to be standardized, and countless new songs would be written for spiritual growth and education. All of these reforms would help to spring in what is known as the Carolingian Renaissance, a cultural movement seeking to rebirth many aspects which are perceived to have been lost in the prior centuries. Most all of the cultural advancements of the age could be tied back to this creation of a new empire, a new idea of Christendom, and a new and empowered church. In addition to these church aspects, there were further reforms within the currency, which standardized coinage tied to silver. This replaced the gold-based currency of prior, which had spun off into many competing currencies due to the lack of gold within Europe. To add on to this, written laws on financial record keeping would work to diminish corruption and create a more common economic framework. Money lending would also rise in importance, with the monopoly on the practice being granted to the Jews living within the empire. The Jews would come to be increasingly important within these urban economic and financial roles, as Christians were discouraged from these practices both by social ideals and the banning of usury by the church. Architecturally, an entirely new movement would emerge, blending Germanic and Gaulish materials with Byzantine and Roman inspiration. This was characterized by an effort for smoother exteriors and the use of arches, polygons, and domes in construction. This movement would most manifest in those hundreds of new churches and dozens of cathedrals which were constructed, and soon would begin to grow independently generation after generation. It would eventually develop into the Romanesque architecture which characterized the transition to the High Middle Ages. What turned it into a cultural flourishing, however, was the combination of these ideas and tools with the local developments which had taken place over the course of the First Dark Age. Elites within the various localities would utilize the growing pool of tools granted by Charlemagne and the Church to develop their own cultural traditions, thus increasing the uniqueness of each European subculture, rather than making it more uniform, as the reformers had perhaps intended. As an example of this phenomenon, let's look at language and writing. As mentioned before, Charlemagne saturated his imperial court with men considered to be the most learned in all of Christendom, and from different cultures across the realm. One of these men would be Alcuin of York, who was an Anglo-Saxon cleric. The British Isles would remain outside of Charlemagne's patronage, but remain in orbit culturally, as there still remained a large faction of the monastic church which hailed from the island. Alcuin would spearhead the intellectual development which enabled the Carolingian Renaissance, with one of the major reforms being made corresponding to the practice of writing. Previously, words in manuscripts had been written in all capital letters, and without spaces between words. This was done, presumably, to save space and retain simplicity when it came to the alphabet. From the Carolingian reforms, however, adding lower cases and spaces would allow text to be much more legible, and help a wider amount of the population learn to read and write. It would come to be expected of almost all clerics, and even learned men outside of the church would indulge in scholarship. This reform, along with widespread production of texts from monasteries, which had been relieved of administrative duties, and standardization of laws, liturgies, and the church hierarchy, would all lead to an explosion of writing across Europe, as we hinted at prior. Here is where this example comes in, though, as rather than these reforms leading to standardization, it would instead allow various subcultures to create and spread new cultural artifacts. Poems would begin to be made and circle among the elite, with different styles springing up in the Mediterranean versus the Germanic areas in the north. Oral traditions, relying on word of mouth before, can now be written and have the resources needed to be transcribed. Church hymns, specifically set out to be standardized across Europe, would instead diverge into different musical styles as each parish blended with their localities. As a result of these developments, the languages of Old German and Old French would begin to develop within the different regions of Charlemagne's lands. The focus on classical Rome would also add a separate dimension to this. The Byzantines were, of course, outraged when Charlemagne and Pope Leo III claimed Roman imperial transition. Commentators of the time wrote of how the anointment ceremony was botched, leaving Charlemagne's clothes dripping with oil at the hands of the amateur pope. Clearly, Franks and their subject peoples were looked at as being far less sophisticated than the Greeks. In many respects, the Byzantines were correct. The Franks, despite their 250-year dominance within Europe, still lacked in many of the finery that high society demanded, especially when compared to the flowering Byzantine culture to the east. Both the Byzantines and the Arabs would become renowned for their silk finery, their fine silverware, a concept quite foreign to the French of this time. Their advancements in math and engineering, including in hydraulics, as famously applied to the Byzantine throne room, but also in architecture, with the dome of the Hagia Sophia still regarded as one of the finest creations of man. The elites of inner Europe and the Frankish realm would indeed look to the Byzantines consistently for advancements in military equipment, clothing, rituals, and more. But this also produced a demand for a homegrown culture to latch onto. For Charlemagne's circle, this would be the Latin Rome of antiquity. A surge of interest in the literary classics of Virgil and the accomplishments in architecture of the Pax Romana would take place, giving the Westerners a legacy of their own to compete with the Byzantines. This would feed into the pre-Romanesque architecture that we discussed previously, but also in the development of state rituals, writing works, and cultural mythos. One thing very clear in the imagination when the image of the glory of the Pax Romana was brought up was the glory of the imperial capital itself. Rome was the eternal city, built to be a metropolis of marble, inspiring any whose eyes encountered its walls. For Charlemagne, recreating this would be a vital part of any cultural rebirth. Here, though, is where we see either some practicality or a desire to truly create something new from Charlemagne, as he would aim to start this rebirth not in Italy with Rome or Ravenna, but in Austrasia with the Germanic city of Aachen. As mentioned before, this was the closest thing to a capital for Charlemagne, who remained consistently on the move, and it would be the site of the most construction projects, including the Cathedral of Aachen, which was the single grandest endeavor of his reign. The Roman imperial flavor comes in from his other constructions, though, especially in the construction of imperial palaces, mirroring the Roman centers of old. Here, though, Aachen was not the only city renovated, as Charlemagne would build palaces across the empire, hoping again to assert a sort of imperial uniformity in the creation of this new Christendom. We will follow these cultural developments as they filter down across the localities after Charlemagne, But talking about the construction efforts of Charlemagne presents us with an opportunity to finally transition back to talking about the conquest of Charlemagne. As much of a Roman and Christian idealist as Charlemagne was, he was a soldier at heart, and war was where he felt most at home. Most of these cultural developments would be left in the hand of his learned circle which he had gathered, while he departed every year on hard-fought campaigns along the edges of the Frankish Empire. Most imperial reforms he would not formalize himself, instead leaving them to be formalized either by the church or by his successor. He preferred actions which were more practical in solving an immediate goal, and no place offered opportunities for this so much as on the campaign trail. Charlemagne excelled at logistics, having Roman military stories and manuals read to him, many of which spoke of their ingenious constructions used to cross rivers or besiege towns. In areas with as little infrastructure as inner Europe at this time, Charlemagne would be forced to innovate. The rivers would become the main arteries of logistics for the Frankish armies, and forces would often march alongside the river, dragging barges behind them with materials and supplies. Because of this, controlling access to these rivers would be of utmost importance, and most campaigns would involve one or more of them. When overland routes were required, much attention would be given to the logistical side of things, with great care taken to ensure mules and carts, as well as potential waterproofing for harsher weather or crossing streams. It was believed that Charlemagne's armies were so skilled logistically that they could execute intricate pincer maneuvers, utilizing forces of thousands of men, all without direct communication or detailed maps. This was something which only came with experience, something which, as we have seen, Charlemagne's armies had a lot of. But how did Charlemagne have access to these massive resources to be sent to the borderlands year after year? Well, this goes back to the mobilization system that we mentioned when talking about the realm's political formula. The counts would form the main foundation for the army across the empire. These men were tasked by region and would associate with local ecclesiastical authorities to administrate. Each count would have their own band of professional retinues, known as a scara. These men dedicated their lives to war and were loyal specifically to their liege. The practice started with Carolingian rulers themselves, and Charlemagne too possessed the largest of these, which functioned as a small standing army. In fact, the hilly region of the Palatinate in modern Germany would be called this after the Frankish Scaras, as these men of the palace would become a large and influential segment of the population near Charlemagne's imperial capital. Many of these men would also gain land in exchange for royal service, thus establishing their identity onto the region. But back to the military hierarchy, the Scara's professionalism would be the backbone of the army, and they would serve as elite and heavily armored mounted soldiers. Cavalry shock tactics would come later with the couched lance of the Byzantines, something which the Frankish armies did not use due to the lack of stirrup among their horsemen. But these soldiers still presented a serious force. Most men would be armed with a full coat of chainmail, leaving only their legs free so as to stay comfortable while riding without a stirrup. When time for battle came, these men would either dismount to fight on foot or harass the flanks and supply lines of the enemy, spreading disorganization. When the enemy routed, these men would naturally lead the pursuit. In addition to these direct combat roles, though, the Scara would also be important for organizing the other men of the army, as they formed skilled and experienced leaders at a small level. Each elite summoned for war was expected to bring his own retinue and act as the leadership for his own campaign. Below them, though, each free man was expected to be prepared to support the army, with larger landowners joining themselves, and smaller ones supporting a few of their own to go off and fight. While the Scara had their expensive equipment patronized from their leader, these mobilized men would have to buy their own equipment, thus tying mobilization to land ownership and wealth. These levies would possess much simpler equipment, often being required to only bring a spear and shield or a simple flat bow. However, there is evidence of equipment requests increasing from Charlemagne over the course of his reign. And while earlier armies may have only demanded a spear and horse from nobles, later ones would also demand a full chest piece of iron mail. To match this, local production of chainmail would increase during this time, becoming more abundant and cheaper, while still remaining extremely expensive for the lowly levy. Though Charlemagne aspired here too to standardize as much as possible, men from across the empire formed very different military forces, depending on their cultural background and the resources available. Thus, the Frankish armies did not fight as a uniform force, and the campaigns often varied depending on where they were fighting, and from where the men were summoned. Certain regions would specialize more in cavalry skirmishers, while others would specialize as archers or javelin men. In general, those western areas of Latin influence could possess a greater influence of cavalry, while those areas of inner Europe would be much more infantry-focused. Charlemagne would be selective in these mobilization calls, dividing it both by population and region to be specific to military needs. Those who were culturally Frankish, from the regions of Austrasia especially, would have the highest military burden placed upon them, and be continuously summoned for campaigns. Other Germanic cultures would face similar pressure, while the remaining populations remained as regionally useful forces for specific purposes. Due to the loyalty of Charlemagne's subordinates, professional leaders, and quality workmanship of equipment for armor and weaponry, morale would be high among the soldiers. The army was known to be a rather disciplined force, rarely succumbing to disorder and disobedience, or the pool of alcohol and rampant looting. Remaining on the offensive would be another contributing force to high morale, as the lands being looted and destroyed were not the men's own land. Offensive tactics would remain a key advantage to Charlemagne. Most would assume that the advantage in a war lies with those on the defense. While this certainly does have its own advantages, as we will get to next episode, remaining on the offensive also has some overlooked perks. For one, initiative is almost always with the offensive force. Forces can be carefully selected and grouped so as to be superior within one specific area, while defenders are forced to spread their forces to defend several strategic areas of importance. Offensive forces can concentrate, as they already know their grand plan. Local superiority of forces gives a massive advantage in a campaign, and this, combined with high morale, solid logistics, and impressive speed, would give Charlemagne victory after victory in his decades-long reign. He also tended to aim for the enemy's capital, decapitating them with one swift campaign, and then mopping up the resistance later. So what were these grand victories Charlemagne established? Well, his first conquered crown represents one of the most significant. As covered last episode, Charlemagne would advance into the Lombards in 774 at the request of the Pope, defeating them utterly. Instead of adjusting spheres of influence and taking land in the name of the Franks, Charlemagne would instead claim the title of King of the Lombards, utilizing local customs which had developed over the hundreds of years of Lombard rule. Besides adding some legitimacy, this would position Charlemagne to be conceptually higher than a king of several kingdoms, thus building the imperial idea we have covered prior. Local influential dukes, namely that of Friuli in northeast Italy and Spoleto in central Italy, would launch a revolt later that decade, hoping to claim the title of King of the Lombards for themselves, expelling Frankish influence in the process. This revolt would be crushed, however, and Charlemagne would cement both his rule and the special status of Italy by crowning his son Pippin as king in 780. This would give the locals some autonomy, and allow them to mobilize their own resources for their own conflicts, namely against the Byzantines and the Arabs, who threatened them from the sea. Moving on, the primary conflict of Charlemagne's entire reign would be his 30-year Saxon Wars. The Saxons had always remained at the border of Austrasia, menacing the plateau with their vast, untamed lands. After a Saxon raid on a nearby church, Charlemagne would take the opportunity to attempt a full-scale conquest. The Saxons were not just another tribe playing at power, though. They would prove to be a unique and resilient society. They organized themselves regionally, utilizing several local councils to form a loose confederation separated into the main regions of Westphalia, Angria, and Eastphalia. They possessed no centralized authority, only uniting due to a shared cultural background and similar adversity to the advancing frontiers of Christendom. Charlemagne would, in 772, launch his first invasion, aiming at a population center with the sacred tree used to rally the local people behind the pagan culture. His men would succeed, cutting down the tree and forcing locals to accept Christianity. Here is where the Franks would run into the major theme of their roadblocks, however, as without a centralized authority, there was no central route which could easily and quickly topple the Saxon society. Each region organized itself. A nominal authority meant little if the population itself remained hostile. This would manifest quickly, with major revolts taking place across Saxon land against the Franks through the next decade. The revolters would be crushed in battle after battle, with populations forcefully Christianized, but this still did not break their resolve. The pagan Danes to the north shared many cultural aspects with the Saxons, as well as a similar Norse religion, and so would allow Saxon refugees to flee into Denmark after each of Charlemagne's campaigns, while also allowing Saxon soldiers to march back into Saxony to participate in the next year's revolts. In addition to this, a charismatic leader known as Widukind would begin to spearhead Saxon resistance, allowing for several organized armies to attempt the reversal of Charlemagne's conquest. By 782, Widukind would lead a major revolt, successfully taking several Frankish settlements in the Saxon lands and massacring the population. Charlemagne would respond in kind, marching in and pushing back the Saxons, before indiscriminately executing 4,500 Saxon locals at Verdun. This campaign would be followed by the Saxon Capitularies, which forbid Saxon paganism, offering death if locals were found to be indulging in these practices. The Saxon Wars would continue in their brutality for another 20 years, though with resistance becoming more sporadic. Widukind would be found and converted to Christianity, while the new borderlands with the Danes would be fortified by Charlemagne and the route between the lands cut. To cement the Danes, the laws against the local Saxons would become less restrictive, with the views of church officials such as Alcuin coming to take precedence. These views, focused on reconciliation and promoting acceptance based on free will, rather than through forced conversion. Still, Christianization was a prime objective, and would be largely successful under Charlemagne. The Saxon lands could be considered pacified by the early 800s, as the Danes considered but ultimately rejected the idea of continuing the war in the name of the Saxons. Elsewhere on the plateau, Charlemagne would end the relationship of de facto independence shared by many tribes within the Frankish orbit. Bavaria would be the main example, as although they had remained nominally subservient to Austrasia for some time now, they experienced almost complete independence in reality. They had even aligned themselves with the Lombards through ties with the two ruling families. Bavaria, during the 8th century, had come to act as a kingdom in their own right, sponsoring the expansion of the church and the monastic traditions in their lands. They would lobby for papal support in the construction of new abbeys and Christianization of their still sporadically pagan population. They would, however, be forced to recognize Frankish domination with the rise of the Carolingians, and soon their support would become expected, even if it still remained their choice in practice. Charlemagne would utilize this break in perception between nominal subservience and real independence to create a pretext for war in 788. Here, he would claim their leader, Tassilo III, of neglecting obligations to his father in Aquitaine over 20 years previously, and march in to replace him. This clearly leaned on Charlemagne's claimed authorities of revocation, which still remained among his subordinates. Bavaria would prove to be no match for the Frankish armies, and their leader would be deposed and replaced with the Frankish appointee. The Carantanians, further within the Eastern Alps, would also be caught up in this, as they had to pledge allegiance to Bavaria in the 740s to escape the resurgent Avar threat. Thus, the Carantanians, too, would become folded in with Charlemagne. As for the other tribes on the plateau and the western Riverlands, they too would feel the Frankish wrath. Many tribes had offered similar arrangements of nominal submission to either the Avars or the Franks, and Charlemagne would utilize both this and acts of raiding to launch campaigns across the Elbe or into Bohemia. The local tribes would not be made part of the empire, as this would have required an effort akin or even greater than the Saxon Wars to be made a reality. But the tribes would be forced to offer more real submission, including a significant tribute to Charlemagne. The last of the imperial major campaigns within Inner Europe, though, and where we will end our episode today, is against the Avars themselves. The Avars had long competed with Franks for dominance over the scattered tribes of Inner Europe, and with Charlemagne's ascendants pushing all the way across the Alps, the Avars would be provoked. They would launch raiding parties into Bavaria and Italy, and so encourage Charlemagne to respond. Several campaigns would be launched into Avar territory proper, along two main axes, one being the Danube River, and one being through Carantania from Pippin in Italy. Charlemagne's campaign would take him along the Danube, where he would seize several fortresses, making up a significant Avar defensive effort known as the Ring. This attack by Charlemagne would not be conclusive, however, and he would soon be distracted by other demands. His son, Pippin of Italy, and the ambitious leaders of Friuli would finish the conflict, though. They would ally with several Slavic forces surrounding the Alpine passes of Carantania, and launch a strike directly to the heart of Avar territory. A Slavic general, allied with the Italian Duke of Friuli, named Voinemir, would lead this attack and successfully take the primary Avar administrative center, fully collapsing their defenses. Italian forces would follow this up with the full defeat of Avar forces, successfully shattering their 250-year reign over Carpathia. We will follow the aftershocks of this collapse in much more detail in 2 weeks, but for now, we can know that the Franks extended their influence along the Danube into western Pannonia. With all of these conquests, Charlemagne would claim the title Emperor of the Romans in 800. Charlemagne would see this title as more of a personal honorific, celebrating his conquests. He had almost doubled the Frankish realm and solidified their domination over many states. He had seemingly reversed Frankish fragmentation and transformed the aristocracy into a loyal bureaucracy. For Charlemagne, he had revived the Roman Empire in the West, a concept known as the Renovatio Imperii, and put it on a track to be the preeminent empire of Christendom. By 814, all but one of his sons would die prematurely, and so he himself would die, leaving the United Empire to his son Louis. Louis was a seasoned administrator, having ruled Aquitaine as an autonomous kingdom under his father for several years already. Louis would, however, find that his father's visions and seemingly unbreakable accomplishments would not fully align with the realities of Inner Europe, and rather than a revived, standardized Rome, there would instead be a dynamic, fractured Europe. Thank you for listening to Between the Seas. I hope you enjoyed this special on the life of Charlemagne, and I hope you can join me next week as we examine counterpoint after counterpoint to the seemingly unstoppable nature of the Frankish Empire within Inner Europe. With that, this has been Jacob, and I hope that you too can have a fraction of Charlemagne's ambition, though hopefully with some more humility.